From Amaya Media, you're listening to Tales of the Trade, a show about the UAE's entrepreneurs and pioneers, and the stories not just behind their companies, but also the communities they brought to life. I'm Chirag Desai. Now, I hope you're staying safe and using this imposed isolation to perhaps take a breather, focus a bit on yourself and the things that the regular hustling life that we're used to doesn't quite let you do. And hopefully also reconnect, albeit virtually, with the people who matter. I also want to take a moment to thank everybody on the front lines. We've got some tremendous medical staff who are working very hard around the clock. But we also got a lot of people in logistics, supermarkets, deliveries, and restaurants who are doing everything possible to make our home isolation just a little bit better. So this will actually be our last episode of this season of Tales of the Trade. The episode you're about to hear was recorded a few weeks ago before all this came to a head. And while we were working on a couple more, it just makes sense to stop here and instead plan towards the next season once things ease up. We also had a couple of bonus features in the works. These were due to air in April, and I'm hopeful we'll still be able to share them with you, albeit with a few weeks' delay. Now, our focus this season has been around scaling a business. That includes many things, whether it's just scaling up for more customers and more employees, operating your business into milestone years, the 5th year, the 10th year, and beyond, or expanding to additional locations and territories. Now, if you remember on season 1, we'd spoken to Tom Arnold, who started out as a chef in training under Shannon Bennett and went on to launch Tom & Serge in Dubai. And his company now leads 6 different F&B brands that operate in the country. And although today's story takes a slightly different approach in the hospitality space, interestingly, it talks about the same characteristic we highlighted with Tom, focus.
I don't lose focus at all. I get focused on something. I can juggle a lot of things, but I'm still focused on end result. It's been very clear for me from day one what I wanted to do with this brand. And everything I've been doing is to get to that point.
Even though he personally isn't a huge fan of the word, and you'll find out why in a little bit, in today's parlance, our guest today, Samer Hamde, is definitely an entrepreneur. In fact, I would go further to say he's a serial entrepreneur. On this episode alone, you'll hear us talk about 5 different businesses he started. And to him, entrepreneurship has a lot to do with having the mindset to just go out and do it.
You know, people are always scared to start. And once you do start and you mess it up a couple of times, you won't be so scared anymore. It's like learning to swim. You just have to do it. You can't just read about it and ask people, what is it like to swim? Jump in the water. So if you're not willing to take that step on your own, that's fine. My dad was super corporate. Like, my dad just retired, and he was in companies and ran a company that had 25,000 employees in Saudi. It was, for all intents and purposes, was a gigantic, you know, corporate guy. My mom set up an ad agency in Riyadh in the 90s when women didn't work. She set up an all-women's ad agency. So this is one within one family where you have a super corporate guy married to a super entrepreneurial woman, you know? So you just have to do it. And my dad would never start his own business. No way. He will never do it. He's not that guy. He doesn't care. He likes being in an organization and corporate. So if you're not ready to jump in the water, to learn how to swim, honestly, get a job. Be amazing at it. You might end up running that company in the future. Stability and security. But just don't go into something, and if you mess it up once, just that's it. We've all messed up. I can't even tell you the things I've messed up.
Now, as you just heard, Samer grew up in Saudi Arabia, but our story begins in Beirut, Lebanon, where he was pursuing his master's.
I studied English literature. Most people always look at me like, what?
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I studied literature. I didn't do it because I loved it. I did it because it was easy and gave me a lot of free time to do other things that I wanted to do in college that I wouldn't have done if I was in, you know, engineering.
But you did a master's in English literature.
Half a master's. I left halfway through. I realized I'm done. Like, there's nothing more they can give me. It sounds really, like, silly and cocky to say, but I have this weird theory about education, at least higher education, that what you're paying for really is the experience. What you're paying for is really making contacts and meeting people that become your friends for the rest of your life, and then you might end up creating something amazing together in the future. So if you're always in the library studying, you're missing out on that. You can just sit at home. So I saw all the majors around me just living in the library. I was banned from the library for a stupid reason.
Oh, no, now I want to know the reason, obviously.
Okay. I was a kid, mind you. I had friends who were med students and friends that were business students and engineering, and they would sometimes meet up in the library to study. So they'd be like, what are you doing? Come by. I'm like, okay, cool, I'll come by. I had nothing to do. I'd just come by. Like, without, I didn't even carry a backpack in college. I didn't carry books around. And I would take the RFID stickers off chairs that are there for like inventory purposes and stick them on like my friend's shoes. So when they'd walk out, they'd start beeping. And then people would be like, what are you taking? What are you stealing? They're like, oh, I'm not stealing anything. And then CCTV footage and yeah, they're like, this is you. I'm like, it's not me. They're like, I had long hair. They're like, this is exactly you. And this is this guy. No, it's not me. And then they're like, yes, it's you. So I wasn't allowed to use the facilities for a semester.
Your friends didn't realize that you were putting RFIDs on their shoes?
No. So yeah, so I studied literature and I was halfway through my master's. My brother, my younger brother, who was at Embry-Riddle in Florida, one of the best flight school in the world, got a job at Air Arabia in Sharjah. He's like, I'm moving to the UAE, basically. And my dad was like, why don't you, you know, finish up and go meet him? And I'm like, I'm just going to go now. He's like, okay. So I moved out here, passed up a job at a huge company. I'm talking 2004. They were offering me like almost 20,000 dirhams a month. I passed that up for a production assistant job on a movie with Warner Brothers on Syriana.
I can kind of understand why you may have done that, but how did you find yourself there?
Oh, I went for an interview at Ogilvy, and the PR director who I was interviewing, and I told him, you know, I'm into films. Me and my brother used to shoot movies when we were kids. We still make these crazy little films. He's like, you should go, you know, my friend's working on this film. You should go meet him. So I went and met him. He's like, I can make you a PA, but that's about it. I'm like, yeah, I don't care, whatever. Obviously, like no money, like not no money, but like you know, 800 bucks for like over three months. And then halfway through a big scene in the desert, I'm in my cargo shorts and boots. I get a call from Impact BBDO saying the general manager wants to meet with you for like a final interview. And BBDO was like one of my top choice agencies, I would say, at the time, mostly because they were in Emirates Towers and I freaking love those buildings. They're still my favorite buildings in the world. So I went into this interview in shorts at an ad agency. And
like you went directly from the shoot?
I was staying in Sharjah at the time. Like my brother and I were, because he was working for Air Arabia, so we were staying in freaking, I'm not going to go back there and come back. It didn't make sense. I'm like, listen, I'm in shorts. He's like, yeah, it's fine, just come by. I'm like, okay. So, but I'll never forget this guy. His name was Alex Al-Gapan. He moved to Canada eventually. Alex says to me halfway through the interview, gives me that look. He's like, you won't stick around. I'm like, what? He's like, this is not for you. You're not going to stick around. You're going to do amazing work here, but you're not going to stick around. I'm like, you know what? That's actually, I don't know if I'll stick around. You're right. He's like, so why don't you go do what you really want to do? I'm like, I don't know what I really want to do yet. So he ended up giving me the job. So again, from 20,000 dirhams offer to 6,000 dirhams. That was my salary. I was very happy. I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, $6,000.
Alex's prediction would come true in about 9 months when Summer spotted an opportunity within the work of the agency. The various providers they were using to run events, according to him, weren't doing a great job. And so he figured out a way to get in touch with Chill Out Productions. They're a leading events company here that runs, among others, the Dubai Jazz Festival.
I was like, in half a suit, I refuse to wear a tie half the time. I hate wearing suits. Pitched an
so
idea to these guys.
So your definition of half a suit is no tie?
Yeah, I guess. That's, yeah.
I mean, you realize that's more like 90%.
Suit. Yeah, like 85%.
Okay. Okay.
Let's not get technical right now. So anyway, so I went and sat with these guys and they're four partners. And I said, listen, I want to do corporate events. I want to do, you know, I have creative ideas. I want to do corporate events and stuff. I want half the company, but you guys are going to set it up, basically. They're like, sure. Again, I would have been happy with like 15%. Obviously, if they hear this now, they'd be like. So they're like, sure, take 50%. They're like, who is this kid? He's 25 or 20. Yeah, I was turning 25. They're like, yeah, sure. Go do whatever you want. I went back to the BDO. I quit.
What you pitched them was 50% of that new unit that would be built.
Yeah. I want to set up a corporate events management company. I want you guys to take 50%. Your investment in me will be my visa, and you give me an office. All right, so I basically got a little office in their office. It's pretty quick, the rise to profitability. Like a couple of months, we were making a ridiculous amount of money. With me, I was a one-man show. I didn't really have a team. I had like our finance person in the office, but I didn't have like a designer, so I was kind of winging it. And we used to produce the Dubai Film Festival. When I say produce, I mean anything involving audiovisual and production came through us. And I created a couple of new intellectual property brands, like IPs, like the Comedy Convention. We did a huge comedy festival in 2009 at the peak of the economic crisis at the time.
But the economic crisis of 2009 did hit his company soon after. And although this brought an end to Summer's event career then, it became a starting point for his life in F&B. It started out with a few friends throwing house parties that had over 300 people show up on a Thursday night, and eventually became, with his partner Amir, his first venture in nightlife, the One-in-One Club at the Monarch Hotel in Dubai.
And the realization was simple. Well, the reason I stopped doing corporate events is I didn't want to do services anymore. I didn't want to, you know, bill 10 million dirhams a year and then have to run after people for like 9,900,000 for a year, which is what happens with most event companies. Nightlife was a cash business. I knew my music really well. I thought if I could bring that into a professional business, it would do well. And the place was very successful. But I learned really fast that if you don't have good lawyers, you can get messed around with very quickly here by landlords. And that deal we had paid a deposit. We had put in a sound system and whatever. We had spent money on the place. And then the owning company kicked out the hotel management company and then brought in a different one. And we got thrown out with it. So like, we don't want work clubs in this hotel. The management company had no right signing an agreement with you guys. So what they did was like kind of illegal. But we got messed up because of it. So like, it's 2020 and they still have my deposit. I mean, but like, just to put things into perspective, how things go here. And there's no remorse from these people. It's not like it's these two kids trying to run a business. You know, we took $100,000 from them when they were like in their 20s. It's fine. Let's give it back. It's not. It's like, oh, well, we don't know what to do. We're in court.
And that happened, and you just went around and said, it's fine, I'll try another place.
Like, yeah,
you
didn't. Yeah, but I immediately, I'm like, I'm not doing that mistake again. So I just, it never happened after that. Like, I learned immediately that sometimes everything has to be black and white. Everything has to be in my favor to some extent. Obviously, most people won't sign things that are to one side. But when, for me as an operator, investing money in real estate, in a location.
Yeah, in a physical space.
I can't
be
a hostage to the landlord.
So taking that lesson, armed with a friend who was a lawyer, Summer eventually met the GM at the address Dubai Mall, who agreed to let them flip over a cigar lounge into what became one of his flagship spaces, Republic, in 2011.
I was playing Knights of the Old Republic on Xbox. It's a Star Wars game.
So it was just like a... It was just...
No, I was just... Yeah, I was actually on the phone with my friend to Beirut, and he's like, what are you going to call this new place? And I literally picked up the case, the game case, and I was like, thinking Republic or Republic. He's like, oh, that's really cool. That's cool. That might work. And we created this whole identity around it. And it became this like call to arms about like going anti-clubbing. So I went to Rida Rad from TBWA, who was a regular at One-on-One. I was like, you want to partner up? I always had a huge like advertising crush on TBWA. So I really wanted to work with them. And he invested. We all invested in the business together. And, you know, TBWA ended up doing all our marketing. All our creative, and they created something which till today I still think is one of the coolest brands I've ever had the chance of like working on. And it was an amazing experience. We made a lot of money. We made a lot of friends. We made a lot of contacts. We kind of turned the industry on its head in the sense that we were the only club that had queues outside but wasn't doing sparklers. You know, the only way you couldn't get into the club is if it was over capacity. Otherwise, everybody was welcome. So there wasn't that animosity and that stress at the door like most other places where you don't want to go because you don't want to get hassled. And this is coming from a guy, I've never been hassled at a club door, like ever in my life, because we always booked and we always got there in advance. But a lot of my friends used to get hassled all the time. So I don't want anyone to experience that at my place. So 2 years in, you know, kind of, it was 2 years. It was time to move on. Let's put it that way.
What, was it your thing to say like, I'm kind of done, I want to move on? Or
no.
Was it kind of more collective?
No, so... Obviously, after 2 years, because our lease was 2 years, if we wanted to renew, it was a much bigger commitment for 5 years. I didn't want to make a commitment to a nightclub for 5 years at the time. It was just one of those things, like it was a conscious decision. We're going to pay more money and stay here for 5 years when we're already 2 years in. Or we just...
Let go. Yeah.
We would just close on a high because we were doing incredibly well.
Yeah.
And again, it just goes to show you, in a market like Dubai, a lot of people sometimes they focus so much on things that really don't add any value ultimately. At least in nightlife, it's really word of mouth. It's really, people have to feel, if they're going to come back to you all the time.
It's a social component as well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the third space. That's what F&B is. It's a third space. So you have your home, you have your work, And you have the third space, which is kind of your social environment. So for you to come back every... we have people that came in every single weekend for 2 years. Like they were in tears the night we were closing. I have videos. I'm like grown men, like crying, like they were upset about it. So it just goes to show you. And even sometimes on my Instagram, I'll post something random,
like a throwback. Or
yeah, and people like I'll get like 60, 70 messages.
You did one recently,
messages.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I got like 60, 70 messages from people, and they'd reply with pictures that they've had from. This is 2011, 2012. So they've had these pictures for 10 years. I mean, it's something to be able to say that, you know, I had a hand in it.
Now, in the post-Republic era, Summer took some time off and actually got into distribution. If you haven't heard of Xylobands, they're the LED wristbands that you find at concerts that are remote controlled to either light up or blink at a specific time or for a specific song. They became very popular thanks to Coldplay's 2012 world tour. Now, if you want to find out more about how Summer got involved with the creator of Xylobands, Jason Riegler, you'll find it on a special bonus episode which will be out next week. This brings us to 2015, and this little place that housed itself in the Jumeirah Beach Residence area of Dubai, that's JBR. My first visit there happened sometime in 2017, and as you walked past the entrance, you weren't greeted by a couple of tall, beefy men who were going to decide whether you could go in or not, but by a room full of arcade games. So you had Marvel vs. Capcom from 1998, Street Fighter 2, and many others that you could spend hours playing before you even noticed these two swinging doors in the back that unveiled a lounge space and a bar, and on most evenings, live music. And once again, as comprehensive as all of that was, the idea came to Summer a little bit randomly.
Wow, I wish I could tell you where it came from. I was sitting at my pool on my laptop, working on something completely different. I had an idea for something. And then I found an old folder of mine that had arcade emulators. Literally just sitting there like emulators. I had Space Invaders, I had Centipede, Galaxian, had everything like there. And I started playing. And the music was just put me in this weird mood. And I was really into synth at the time. Like I was, you know, especially now, Dreamwave and Chillwave was like, I was always listening to it. So I just started imagining like walking into an arcade now. Like if I just walked into a place that was an arcade, how would I keep people there? Like, well, it's easy. If we can give them entertainment.
So your actual idea was, I want to have an arcade, but then I want to keep people there.
Yes.
It wasn't, the arcade wasn't the add-on.
No, the arcade was the main thing. I wanted to open an arcade. I didn't care about anything else. That's why it's at the entrance. If it was just part of the concept, I would have stuck it in the corner somewhere. Has he been in Republic?
Yeah.
The flags used to roll up. So what TBWA did was they created these flags of countries, but instead of countries, they were like musicians. So Freddie Mercury had a flag, Kurt Cobain, Madonna, Prince, Michael Jackson, and these flags would roll up, and then we'd project live concerts on the walls. So you'd be sitting in this club at 1 a.m. and suddenly it's like Bon Jovi live in Tokyo 1989 or Guns N' Roses live in wherever. So that was a completely different experience. That was like more like a sing-along, like the whole club kind of working together. With Stereo Arcade, it was stereo sound, left and right channels. Your left channel was the nightclub. Your right channel was the live music bar. So people wanted to go out and hear live music. They could. They wanted to go and party and dance. They could. So the people sometimes that went to the bar side versus the club side were from two different worlds. They would never, under any circumstance, would they ever, ever connect in the same place. It's impossible. Some of my biker friends would be in the bar. They would never set foot in the nightclub. And they were there every day for like 3 years, and they never went into the club. They were just there for the live music.
Stereo Arcade was wildly successful as a concept. But by 2018, things had started to take a turn. This was the first time he'd raised money, and he had 15 shareholders, which meant it was turning into a case of just too many cooks.
People had different visions for what the brand should be and shouldn't be. I owned the brand, but I was still trying to be as diplomatic as humanly possible. Unfortunately, in this business, sometimes you have to stand your ground on certain things. There was a lot of that. But once you have a lot of that happening internally, it just trickles down. So, and we started minimizing the bands because we realized how much money they were costing us and they weren't really bringing in the footfall because the hype was starting to die down. So once the hype started to die down, we realized that people were really coming because it was hyped up for 2 years. But
yeah,
2 years is not bad for hype. And then we stopped live music, which was really painful for me because I love live music.
That's I remember being very disappointed when we were told that. Yeah,
and we were ready to go. Like we had 7 nights a week of live music, which was insane. Some of my favorite bands, like not just from Dubai, like ever, like Vandalay, they used to come play in Stereo, and the Box Stones used to play there. Like we had everybody, Abri and the Funk Radio. I mean, we had so many of these guys that came through. Odyssey from DC did a gig there. We did something with Red Bull. So we had so much activity going on. People were not spending money anymore. So I started seeing a dip in the market overall, and I'd speak to other friends that own other clubs, and they were seeing it as well. Then eventually, you're making a quarter of what you used to make. You can't sustain the business anymore. Sometimes, killing a project is the smart thing to do. So me asking people to sink in more money, and we all lost money on Stereo Arcade. If we were going to sink in more money, so to make that amount of cash and revenue, you need to spend that much on everything else. It wasn't like you just open the doors, people would walk in and you're done. No, you had to spend X amount to do X times two. It's a fact of life. You look at the budget, some of the bigger clubs here like Skybar or like White and Soho Garden. I mean, their staff costs are astronomical. I mean, I can't even imagine how many zeros are in there. But the reason they're successful is they had a humongous team behind them, and they've treated their team incredibly well. And you know, with me, I always kept a very small team. Like my direct team, my marketing and operations, was like three people versus some clubs that have 30 people doing PR, marketing. 30. They're on the payroll. But these 30, when it's at that level, you know, again, so that was part of the learning. Trying to minimize the cooks ended up being maybe not the best idea at the time. But again, the place was too small to justify spending more.
With another venture done, another batch of learnings registered, Samir embarked on a new journey, breaking away from nightlife this time to open up his first restaurant. More on that after this break. Hey there. As you know, we work very closely with businesses in a few different ways. We make podcasts for some of them, like The Lighthouse in D3 or Comebook. And many companies partner with us, and you hear their ads right here during this break. We wanted to share with you some local businesses that could use your help. And today I'd like to tell you about one of our guests from season one, Frying Pan Adventures. They're a lovely sister-run food tour company showcasing the city and its hidden gems. Here's Arva Ahmed, their chief executive muncher.
For the past 7 years, our small but really passionate team has been taking people on walking food tours around old Dubai. We're invested in the little guy, in the street corner heroes. But right now, our business, like many others in the global tourism industry, has come to a complete standstill with the COVID-19 situation. So I've got a request for you. Please help us keep the lights on by getting a gift voucher for a future tour. I know going outdoors feels like it's never going to happen again, but it will. And when we do, we're going to help you experience old Dubai to the fullest. Your voucher is going to be valid for an extended period of 2 years, and you can get it for any amount, big or small, using the 10% discount code SAVE10. You won't just be helping us get through this difficult time, but you'll also be supporting the small restaurants on our tours that we'll visit and buy from once things get back to normal. You can grab your voucher anytime before April 30th at fryingpanadventures.com. Thanks for helping to make a difference.
Once again, the code to use is SAVE10 for 10% off. You'll find links to their site in the show notes, along with a link to the episode from season one if you'd like to get to know more about them. Welcome back. I'm Chirag, and you're listening to the season finale of Tales of the Trade from Amaya Media. By the time Stereo Arcade was closing up in 2018, Samir Hamdeh was already digging away at his current business, a modern Japanese-inspired space called Akibadori. And although by now Samir had been in the F&B space for about 7 years, this was actually his first foray into something that wasn't a nightlife venue.
Ultimately, everyone talks about exits in every business. It's like the dream, right? Maybe tech, it's a bit more heavy than F&B. But with F&B, if you don't have a brand you can replicate easily, you're not going to exit ever. It's going to be a one-off mom-and-pop store, open it in some neighborhood in New York City and just live there. With Akibadori, I wanted something that I could take anywhere and it would stand on its own 2 feet. So starting with Dubai Design District was a very strategic location for me. It's a corner unit, ground floor, high ceilings. Incredible client base there, wonderful landlords, super supportive, everything we've ever needed. They were always there, even silly things. And D3 opened up a lot of doors.
How did you narrow down on the concept you actually narrowed down on? Because as you mentioned as well, like you were not into the cooking and the chef's
side. I'm still not into it.
Yeah, but you have created a very niche concept.
I wanted a concept that can still be super competitive in this market, because at the end of the day, people still want to go out. People still want experiences. So if I can give them an interesting experience in a Japanese space, then it's a win-win. For me, the Japanese options in the city were either fast food, like food court style, or high-end. I wanted to be in the middle. But I didn't want to be in the middle and do a traditional Japanese restaurant. And I've never been to Japan. So how would I open a restaurant that's traditional if I've never even been there? That's one. Two, I actually hate the word traditional and authentic. I think they're horrible words. I think they should not be in the language. You should not call your brand authentic if you're not in that city with your... It doesn't make sense to me. So I don't want to do an authentic Japanese. I wanted to do a random Japanese concept that doesn't look like anything out of Japan. But people might think that it is Japanese because, yes, these are Japanese elements. Akiba short for Akihabara, which is an area in Tokyo that now is known for, you know, the otaku are there, the kids that are like always on video games and the big fans of manga and anime and everything. But before all of that, I always go back. I don't know why I'm stuck in the past, but I went back to after the war when U.S. soldiers would come to Japan and where the what they call the tourist jacket was born, where they would bring baseball jackets, like Letterman jackets from the U.S. And they'd ask a tailor to rip out the arms and like put in like these really cool Japanese embroidery arms on the jackets. And that whole industry was born out of that. These same guys who wanted to get American products could only get it in Akihabara. It was like the black market or the gray market or whatever you want to call it. So I thought if I was going to open a, you know, under the radar kind of like illegal goods store, what would it look like? It would look like super bright, lots of colors, very confusing for the authorities. So that's how my brain works. It's weird, but that's how it is. So I created this fake indoor street. But I don't want it to be kitsch or cheesy, so no one's going to believe they're on an indoor street. Nobody. Nobody in their right mind would say, yes, I'm in an alleyway. So I wanted to make it ridiculous, which is why the big signs are there, the big arches are there, the arcade's there, the cobblestone interior, which is annoying for like my staff because they're always like, oh, the tables get stuck and whatever. We fixed a lot of those anyway. It was one of those teething pains. But so that's how the concept came about. And then I kind of put it together, worked on the brand. And it's very important for me to always own a brand. So Akibadori, if you Google Akibadori, it's just Akibadori. There's no other Akibadori in the world. Even if you Google Stereo Arcade, there is no other place called Stereo Arcade. Republique was different because Republique is like such a freaking French thing. La Republique. So you can't really own it.
Now, the cuisine of Akibadori is niche in and of itself. But there is one element that stands out. A Neapolitana pizza oven. Now, I'm talking about those wood and coal-fired ovens that heat the pizza up to over 400 degrees and pop out a crispy and yet chewy dough in just under 60 seconds. Now, I didn't know this until I visited Akibadori sometime in 2018, that there is actually a tremendous following for this pizza, originally from Napoli, but studied and engineered in Japan. And if this is something you want to know more about, the backstory of how all of this got going in Japan and how Akibadori picked up on this concept is also going to be on our bonus episode next week.
So yeah, so the pizza just became like the addition to Akibadori. That's why I gave it its own brand, which is Tokyopolitan.
Right.
It's Tokyo Neapolitan Pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, me and my brand brain, I'm like, let me create a off-brand in case we want to maybe move that
do
brand.
Do something, separate. Yeah. Because I remember you had a separate Twitter account for it and I was wondering
do.
Why. Yeah,
we do, even for Instagram we do. Yeah, yeah. Because it is a standalone brand in a way, you know? And just like all the other little concepts inside Akiba, like Kashipan is sweet. It's sweet. It's sweet bread. It's a bakery. So I could open a little Kashipan bakery if I wanted to. It depends on when the opportunities come up, right? And the brands are ready to go. So I have four brands or five brands sitting in Akibadori that could be separate brands. Or it's the whole Akibadori. Dori means street, so it's the whole street. Our menu started off with 60 items. We're at 100 now. And our kitchen is tiny. Like tiny. It's the tiniest kitchen you'll ever see for a restaurant that size. 120 seats. We got really lucky with our head chef, Tony Antonio. He's been in the, you know, Asian food industry for like a decade. And he comes up with creative, really creative recipes and stuff. And he works with Billy, my operations director, on fine-tuning them. Billy's super creative also with the menus. He's responsible for like most of the menu as well. Because that's not my thing. Let's put it that way. I can bring people into a restaurant. I can PR the hell out of it. But creating a menu is not my jam. I'm just not interested in it, to be honest. I have a very weird taste when it comes to food. Like, I like, probably at the risk of getting shot on my way out, like, I like pineapple on my pizza.
No, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
You did not just say that.
I did say that.
You said you always wanted to scale this up. But what was that tipping point for you to say, okay, now we can start doing this? Was it just the opportunity showing up in Saudi?
So obviously the opportunity came up. Several opportunities came up. This one was the best one, in my opinion. And the opinion of my shareholders, of course, because we studied a lot of things together. It's a very diplomatic kind of structure, to some extent, obviously. I own the brand at the end of the day. Yeah. But I'm very cautious and careful with it. And I like to share the wealth. And yeah, so the right opportunity, right location, right partner, right time. We've been working on Jeddah for over a year now.
But when you're mapping out other cities that you're looking at, what kind of criteria are you looking at when you're picking them? Is it just right time and you feel right
about you get, but you get a lot of information on the city. You get, you know, the high traffic areas. What, are there students next door? Is it a student-only town? I wouldn't, you know, there's a lot of factors. So it's a lot of demographic factors, I would say. Also, how protected you are legally, the kind of partner you have there. So there's a lot of elements that come into play. And me surrounded by lawyers. My father-in-law is a lawyer. My brother-in-law is a lawyer. Four of my shareholders are lawyers. So, you know, there's a lot of questions most people wouldn't even think about asking that we ask before we look at it.
But you haven't yet opened Saudi. And you're now sort of already putting the foot in the door for four other options.
Correct.
What is the basis of that decision to say, look, I can expand to five more locations and get them up and running?
I'm working it backwards. I know what people want to buy. I know what kind of F&B business, either, you know, PE firms or other conglomerates want to buy, and I'm building what they want.
Okay.
Which is scalable business, cash rich to some extent, very low overheads, and it's just a sexy investment. So I know what number I need to get to sell that, where I want to sell it, so I can go do it all over again somewhere else.
From an investment point of view,
yeah.
Obviously, as you mentioned, again, you're spending double of what an average restaurant is spending perhaps in Saudi, in Jeddah.
Only on hiring. Staffing it, what most people do is they'll hire someone that works for another restaurant.
Yeah,
so they're like, we'll just get whoever. Like I have a restaurant, I was looking at a restaurant next door, somewhere in Saudi. They pay half what I pay in salaries, but they need triple the staff.
Obviously, because competence is an
exactly. Issue. Yeah. So for me, I'm getting the best of the best, and I'm going to make sure they're rewarded because they look after my business at the end of the day. My staff, my team, they're more important to me than anybody. Like literally number one. Number two are my customers. Number three are my shareholders. Number four is number three, my shareholders and my brand are tied. And they know this. They're not jealous. They're fine with it. But my staff, especially my team, my core team, like I'm not hands-on with stuff. I believe people know what they're doing. My job is to make sure the money comes in and people come and that we expand this business to make sure they're secure and their families are secure. So I'm taking care of their livelihood. They're taking care of mine. And I don't want a customer's first impression to be, wow, the staff here are a disaster. It's just, they're just opening, so it's fine. We never heard that in Akiba Dori. No one ever said, oh, there's the first week, they're crap. Nobody. Nobody ever complained about the service. We had one complaint once when the pizza started running out because we used to make half what we used to make now. We make like a limited amount and then we stop making more. So we're good with that. And because we pay better and we treat our customers the way they treat us, which is super loyal and give them the best possible service. Let's put it that way.
And you anticipate, I think, from what I can gauge from what you're saying, that you will replicate that in Jeddah, for example, when it opens.
Of course.
To you be like, to. It has to be perfect.
You can't go, people go in and say, oh, we can always figure it out after. No, you don't get two chances with new restaurants.
But you see that a lot here. You see there's the soft opening and they're like always that. Like that.
They apologize. Sorry, it's a soft opening. Why? Why'd you open? Take an extra 2 weeks. Train your people. It's not the end of the world. All good restaurants do it.
But is it a financial thing?
No, it's a experience thing. Experienced operators would never open without training, ever, no matter what anyone tells you.
If you were to draw a parallel for Akiba Dori, not necessarily in the region, but just worldwide, what would...
Wagamama, in terms of what they were known for and how fast they grew and how long it took and in the cell, it's exactly that. That would be a good roadmap for me.
And so from back when he jumped on a plane over a decade ago to come down to Dubai, joining his brother, and see where life would take him, to churning out a successful venture after another, to launching Akiba Dori, which he's now looking to export out of the UAE, he has the confidence today to be able to say that he can both spot a good F&B opportunity and leverage it into a business. And for Samer, it all comes back to being here, physically here, in Dubai, which he believes was key to some of his success.
Dubai is, at least for me, it's the best place to be in the world for public relations. If you get something successful here, it's much faster for you to get it everywhere. People discovered Akiba Dori not because we were in D3, but because we were in Dubai. If I had opened Akiba Dori in Beirut, probably wouldn't have gone anywhere. But there's so many tourists that come through.
You're talking customers, or you're talking...
Everything. Overall. I mean, Dubai is a great platform to launch things from. In fact, most places, you know, that opened in the region either ripped off a concept from Dubai or took a concept from Dubai. Or even franchises that were super popular in North America became popular in the Middle East because of Dubai. The Cheesecake Factory is the best example. There was a Cheesecake Factory in Saudi when I was growing up.
Was there really?
Yes.
I thought Dubai was their first
exploration. There was a Cheesecake Factory, but only cheesecakes.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
But still,
as a restaurant. It was a Cheesecake Factory. It was okay versus where it is now. It was insane, the difference. And I think the government has created an ecosystem that makes it easy for you to launch things. Definitely much easier than anywhere else in the region, maybe other than Lebanon, where Lebanon, you can just open something over the phone. It's incredible. But it's so easy to conduct business here. It comes with a cost sometimes. Obviously, it's a lot more reasonable than other places when you actually add things. But the amount of opportunities you get by being here, having the kind of airport that we have, the airlines we have like Emirates, the kind of support we get from people like Dubai Tourism and people like Dubai Municipality and whatever, it's incredible. It's like the whole government is working on making you successful. It's really up to you to actually use it. Some people complain, but if they don't know how to use those channels, it's really on them. Like somebody's giving you a room full of tools and you decide you want to call a mechanic. No, it's, dude, freaking pick it up and figure it out. So I think that's where Akiba also got propelled, is that people heard about us in Germany and then Italy because we had there's a video on Emirates, or there was a channel on Emirates that had to do that. So where would you get to do that if you're anywhere else? Nowhere. If you were in the US on any airline, where would you have a channel for a restaurant? It wouldn't happen. So it's little things like this that happen that actually help you. It's just about taking advantage of them.
But you're someone, I think, who, as you mentioned, like you're seeing the opportunity, and if you feel like it's there, you're grabbing and stuff. Right. But there's also the realities of being an entrepreneur, and because you're someone that is inherently positive when it comes to saying, all right, let's give it a go and see what happens. Is that enough?
It's a start, but again, you can't ask someone, like, how do I do this or how do you think? Because honestly, no one took my hand when I was 25 and I wanted to set up my own business. I didn't have someone telling me, you should do it this way. I had to freaking wing it. I had to figure everything out on my own. Till now, I'm figuring things out on my own. You know, I read contracts like a lawyer now. I have lawyers, but I can't wait for people all the time. So it depends on your mindset. If you're willing to get your hands dirty, I'm sure everyone says it's such a cliche, but if you're not willing to get your hands dirty and mess things up, honestly, do yourself a favor and just...
But I think that the important thing is people need to realize that's okay.
Of course it's okay. Yeah. This part of the world, everyone's so stressed about failure, like it's the end of the world. You got up the next day, you freaking moved on. It's like a breakup. People get into relationships for years, then the relationship ends, you move on. It's just this innate fear that some people have of what will others think.
Yeah, yeah. Or that others will think I'm not good enough or I'm a failure because I didn't branch out and do something on my own, and I'm still in a corporate scene 10 years in, right?
Of course.
And
not.
I think it's
that's
crazy.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, but you hear that.
Man, the most successful people are the happiest people. The people that are happy. Not because they're not happy because they're successful. They're just happy regardless of what situation they're in. Man, I've been in situations here I can't even talk about publicly in business. I really can't.
I wish you would, though. But
yeah, I wish I would, but maybe one day in a book. But
No, you got to come back on my podcast.
Anyway. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Maybe one day soon.
Maybe one day, yeah.
This was the season finale of season 3 of Tales of the Trade, hosted and produced by me, Chirag Desai, with support from Abhishek Venkatasubramanian, Sukena Kazmi, and Zainabu Jain. Original music was composed by Rainer Ehrlichs. As I mentioned, there's a bonus episode with Summer where we get into Xylobands, the Japanese pizza scene, and a little bit more, coming to your players next week. Once again, thank you so much for joining us on this season. Tales of the Trade is part of the Amaya Media Network. You can find all of the shows we produce at amaya.media and connect with us on Instagram at amaya.media and at talesofthe.trade.